Our next guest is Professor Harry Glaspick, and he is the Professor Emeritus and Senior Scholar at Osgoode Hall Law School, York University. He has a new book, Law at Work, The Coercion and Co-option of the Working Class. And that's published by Between the Lines, btlbooks.com. And further, he has a new article in Canadian Dimension, also same article. You find a monthly review online along the same lines as how property wins out over against workers. Are you there, Mr. Glaspick?
Yes, I am.
Hey, it's good to hear from you. We're very glad that you could join us. We have just been talking to a very articulate representative of the U of T Occupy for Palestine. And as a professor and one who's seen a lot of demonstrations and on campus and off, what are your thoughts about what's going on there?
Well, it's actually a very important moment, I think. What is so striking about the sit-ins at the various universities is, and they're pretty well worldwide now, is the fact that unlike the sit-ins in which I participated when I was a young student, the students this time are expressing the highest notion of morality. When I was set in Vietnam and things of that nature, there was always this lurking notion that we had a self-interest because we were draftable and we were potentially going to be on the line and have interruptions to our lives and careers, all these things. They weren't the major militators, but we always felt that there was something that served us as well. People sitting in at the moment actually risking their careers a little bit, maybe police repressions, university repressions, all these things, and for no reason except that they think what's going on in the Middle East is just wrong. Now, that is really admirable. I think that is one of the great expressions we've had over recent times about how we need change in our world. So I'm really quite cheered up by the fact that so many people are participating in these encampments and sit-ins at the moment. And I think it also illustrates another aspect. In order for people who are vulnerable and oppressed or believe in causes which to help the oppressed, they actually have to go out and say so in public. They put themselves out there at all times. The forces that actually do the oppression do it, as it were, by stealth. They sit in back rooms and target people who oppose them. And that's what's clear in these university pushes and shoves that we see at the moment. In the press, all you read is about free speech and the free speech of the protesters, but the free speech of the people who say they feel intimidated and they can no longer speak freely, and how terrible all that is. But what's really going on is that the elites, especially donors to universities, are saying to the universities, get rid of these people who are opposing us, but don't mention. And so that the universities are forced into a position to call on their, amazingly enough, their property rights to enforce the views of larger property owners against the people who have no property of their own and therefore must sit in tents on other people's property. So it's an illustration not only of a moral movement, which I think this is, but it's also an illustration of how capitalism sort of biases one view over another in a very, very important and very, very sneaky way.
Mm-hmm. I think it kind of reminds me of that phrase that Bertrand Russell developed actually during his years of protesting wars and such. He said that in this system, I think he said the capitalist system, you have freedom of speech until you need it.
Yeah. That's right. That's a pretty good thing. Pretty good way of saying it, I think. I remember John Clark at OCAP also saying something which bears on this. He said the only way that workers can make themselves felt and heard is by not being where they should be, namely at work. And the only way that the poor people can make themselves heard is by being where they shouldn't be, like a squatter or an encampment at a university.
Yeah. We're speaking to Professor Harry Glasbeck. By the way, I want to remind you, he has a brand new book, Law at Work, The Coercion and Co-option of the Working Class, and that's Between the Lines, btlbooks.com. The way they do these attacks on the students really galls me. You must have seen this article in Atlantic Monthly magazine, and of course Atlantic seems to be leading the charge on all fronts, actually, against speech, against people who are for peace, etc. But the author, who's somewhat distinguished, said the donors have to put their foot down.
Yes.
He said, we've had enough now. The donors got to quit being, weak-kneed. They have to put a stop to this. And actually, since that article was published, it's almost like Congress has jumped into like a lion and is chasing university deans and presidents and holding hearings on whether somebody was wearing a keffiyeh or did he say something about the weather that we didn't like and crushing the will to crush people is there, but they said it explicitly. Just the donors have to do this.
Yeah, there's no question that's the way it works, right? Especially it is more evident in American universities than it is here, but it happens here as well. For instance, I was at York for many, many years as a teacher there, and what was always obvious to us, York is a particularly turbulent campus because it prides itself on being more democratic than others, and I don't know whether that's true, but the people there feel that. But what is also true is that the Board of Governors, and it's a very telltale name, isn't it? The Board of Governors was largely constituted by rich people who gave money. Mm-hmm. And when the chips are down, they just simply say they won't have any money, mm-hmm. and they should do things our way. And that's what happens in all these cases, and they have that power to do so. And in this case, it is, of course, isolated and identified as being Jewish donors because they have a real stake in as they see it, in Israel's well-being. So they put their foot down, and they don't mind calling and saying, unless you presidents act, we'll throw you to the wolves. And and that's exactly what's been happening. I don't think there's any issue about that. I think it's well-recorded and well-documented. And here in Canada, we've had two fairly well-documented pieces, one by Eve Engler, I think, and the other one by Judy Haven, have both identified some of these donors who have put their foot down, as the Atlantic Monthly says.
Yeah, and these are the people, we've talked about this phenomenon in the program before. Literally, it's like in the B-movies. The guy picks up the phone and says, I want those students off the campus.
Right. Right.
It's and I want like you to rough them up.
Rough them up. And I mean, there are lots of incidents like that, right? That's the B-movie, that's the gangster guy.
Yeah.
But in Ontario, for instance, we had Mike Harris say, let's clear out that park when they killed Dudley George. And
he was cursing, etc. That should have been the biggest story.
This is not an unknown phenomenon. What is intriguing to me, at least, is the fact that you can do this without being showing up in public. You see, in a way, you could say, the rich donors are entitled to their opinion as well. They're entitled to express it, just like the pro-Palestinian protesters are. Well, of course they are, but they don't do it in public. They don't go out and say it. They just sit in their big living rooms and use their cell phone to make a couple of calls and say, we're going to remove some money.
And they deny that they even did that.
Yeah, of course. They don't want to be heard.
They said, I don't know anything about that.
They want their names on buildings, but no fuss.
Yeah. Actually, when I see these students, and I think the story of the Oakland Tribune, owned by a reactionary senator named Nolan, the free speech movement began because they had been supporting the integration process in the South with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and they had a table at the University of California, but they had decided that they should picket Mr. Nolan's newspaper because there were no black employees. He picked up the phone and said, throw those guys off the campus now. And they tried.
Yes, of course.
Then they called back and said, well, now there are 20,000.
Yeah.
Maybe we ought to have a new plan.
Yeah, well, that is, I hope that is the reaction that we're getting today, too. Because, but that, as I say, I think it's a movement that deserves admiration, I think.
Yeah. Harry, I want to ask you this. And there's something I really like. The title of your piece, I think it's in Canadian Dimension, is Harry Glasspeak. I like the fact they put your name right in the title, by the way. That means that ears are pricked up all over the country. Oh, Harry Glasspeak on the law, how the law keeps workers' aspirations firmly in check. Laws designed to safeguard rights and freedoms often act as invisible shackles. Now, the phrase that got me is invisible shackles, because that is a good part of your thesis in your new book, right?
Yes, it is. Things
are going on in our minds that have been planted there a long time ago, which really hold us back.
Yeah, it's an interesting, you know, as a person who spent a life in law, it is, I think, the most interesting thing about law. Most people encounter law in the most simplistic way. Law is largely a set of tools and instruments which tell you how to behave, and it coordinates us, right, in case we have too many collisions of one kind or another. Literally, for instance, we're all asked to drive on the right-hand side of the road, and that makes perfectly good sense, right, and to have a law which coordinates and facilitates us. Or you must have a license to be a financial advisor, or you must wear a helmet on a construction site. And these are ways of making us a bit safer, make everything more efficient, more smooth, but allow us as much freedom as possible as we do it. That's the way people encounter law in their everyday lives. Now, those kinds of tools, and although they seem important to people who run into them, are really not all that significant. You could change them, right? We could drive all on the left-hand side of the road, as they do in some countries. You'd be just as safe, right? Nothing much would have changed. Or you could, instead of a construction hat, you could have better scaffolding and other things, right? None of that would matter all that much. These are all just mechanisms of that do not characterize our system of social relations in its essence. But law also, because law, while it pretends to be enlightened and pretend that it elevates individualism, because we think all individuals are unique and we respect every single one of us, law says that it also operates in a capitalist system, and therefore it serves capitalism. But it can't say so outright, because that would do away with its notion that it's even-handed and neutral. Yes. So it has mechanisms which are foundations of law, which it doesn't actually enunciate very often. But they're vital, and it asks all of society's members to internalize them, just as you say. We just accept them. And in particular, there are three things. The notion of that individualism is better than collectivism, that private property, there's the right to exclude other people from your property, is sacrosanct. And that freedom to contract, that is the right to make your arrangements as an individual, is sacrosanct. And nobody should interfere with any of that. Mm. But because wealth, property, the ownership of the means of production, call it what you will, is so unevenly divided in our society.
By the way, it's never mentioned, as you point out in your book.
Yeah.
You're not. They don't say, I'm the owner of the means of production.
No, never. We never even
I'm a pillar of the community. I provide jobs.
Yeah, we never even mention the word class in law, except to say class action when lawyers can make some profit. And so that you get that notion, those notions, when individuals, therefore, were all unique, bargain with each other, we shouldn't interfere with them. Well, workers have no money. They need to work to survive. They've got no choice about that. And they, therefore, have to enter into bargain with people who have property, who have money, who don't have to invest their money if they don't want to. They can buy just another yacht if they'd like. So what the worker, but the law says, the person with property is just an individual like the person without property. So we respect their bargain. That means workers always start behind scratch. They must always try to form combinations to eliminate competition amongst themselves. They must also try to get legislation to get their, use their numbers to get governments to impose conditions of employment. Otherwise, they're going to get screwed. And so that so that is the natural position. That's the normal position. Now, those natural, normal positions, of course, are immensely biased towards the people who have the wealth. And that's built right into our system and our everyday practices. Now, everybody walks around thinking this is normal. There's nothing normal about it. It's a vicious system that is being furthered by the neutral lady of justice handling the scales of justice in her hand, who's always blindfolded to pretend that she's neutral.
You know, you remind me of Eleanor Marx gave a May Day speech in which she said, we want to end unemployment amongst the wealthy.
I like that line. I like the line also, which says that if work was so good, the wealthy wouldn't let us have it.
you make the point that a gentleman is somebody who doesn't have to work. And that's why we honor them.
Yeah, that's right.
Explain what a gentleman is and how powerful that is.
It's a sort of quaint language today. We don't use that language of the 19th century.
Actually, we had a funny phenomenon.
But the whole idea was that certain laws didn't apply to gentlemen because they didn't have to work, so that therefore they could not be servants, they could not be employees. And I tried to make that point in the book, by the way, by showing A, workers are generally oppressed by law, by legal means, but at the other end, when the actual workers who look like employees at law are members, they're really the personification of capital, namely the executives in large corporations, then all of a sudden all the rules about employment law fall away. They just drop away. Mm-hmm. And then they get this huge remuneration, which is, of course, a new feature of that form of capitalism. These things are explicable and understandable. And I'm a firm believer that unless people can see how illegitimate, how immoral the system is, they will not work to dismantle it. And so I think that's the first step. I think you get, by looking through the legal lens, you can see how illegitimate the system really is.
Yeah. I was thinking of the film, The Big Lebowski, where the dude abides. Capitalism abides. I think you make the point in the book at the end of the day, you get some reforms, but because of the design of the system, those reforms begin to erode.
Yes.
And the referees all cheat on the players,
all the time. For instance, I'm involved with a health and safety group at the moment, and people there are very, very, very hard at work and decently at work to try and reform the workers' compensation scheme because it's malfunctioning at many levels. And they're looking for reforms in the workers' compensation scheme. At the end of the day, the problem is that the workers' compensation system is just a way of buying off the working class, because it says that if we pay you sufficiently well, the numbers of injuries, illnesses, and deaths can be tolerated. I think that's it's an anti-social and anti-human starting point, but that is the starting point of our compensation system. And of course, it doesn't. Even if it works better, it doesn't diminish the number of people who are going to get hurt or be made sick or die. That requires much more positive action than merely paying off the people who are hurt, sick, or die. So I think that is a typical example of what reform is. A workers' compensation scheme was a reform of a judicial system which gave workers nothing. But it's still a reform, and therefore it becomes diluted and adulterated over time. But even when it works well, it doesn't change the basic proposition. Because amongst all those people who get hurt on the job, right, and made sick and die, there's not one boss. We won't find one boss. It's a class problem. Yeah. Only workers get hurt. And it's as clear as they could be.
Yeah, I, as a personal witness, I got knocked off a truck with ammonia fumes, and I didn't say a word about it. I needed stitches because I didn't want to lose the job.
Exactly. And I'm sad to hear it, but it's typical. For instance, just a number, we have something like 275,000 claims annually which are compensable in Canada. But there are at least as many where no claims are made at all for the kind of reasoning that you just put forward. So that you're talking about 750,000 people roughly every year who are hurt and injured and so on. Their families are affected psychologically.
They're exercising their right not to complain.
And that's not considered a public health crisis. Although it's much worse, by the way, because it happens every year. So there are millions of people over time. And we just ignore it because, again, it's normal. It's naturalized. And I don't think it should be tolerated.
We're speaking to Professor Harry Glasspiegel. The book is Law at Work, The Coercion and Co-option of the Working Class. It's Between the Line Books, btlbooks.com. And I can't resist asking the question that puzzles almost everybody when they hear it. How is a corporation a person?
Well,
it really bothers all the persons I know.
Yes, I know it. So it should bother us all, I think. It's only person because the law says it is. I mean, there is no other way of saying it. The law can create what it doesn't create a person in the physical sense, of course, in the legal sense. So it has all the capacities of an individual. I think the most, for my perspective, interested as I am in capital labor relations, the corporation is an immensely pernicious tool that the law has created. And what it does, it allows capitals to be combined. And that is why we make it easy for people with money to form a corporation, because we think that's efficient. If you get lots of little capitals put together into one big sum of capital, that will be instantly more efficient and create more wealth, which then will trickle down to the masses. That's the way the law presents the picture.
Trickle, yeah.
But of course, by definition, therefore, we encourage the formation of corporations because we want to collectivize capital. And then law turns around, it's got to be an individual. And it says it has to be an individual because you need it to be, one, a single property owner so it can engage in competitive marketing to create larger accumulations of wealth which has been socially produced. It's the ideal capitalist. And, of course, what is ideal about that? Is that you have a collective, so it's given all these little capitalists are given more power than they otherwise would have economically and politically. Yeah. It allows them to intervene politically because they can claim that they have political interests as individuals. Now, corporations, of course, have no soul or mind of any kind.
Yeah.
None.
And this Frankenstein...
So we pretend that it's all normal. So we talk about the corporate sector.
Yeah. And this, he can now participate in politics, right?
Like a football team.
they get to join in politics, give money to campaigns.
Absolutely.
And it's a Frankenstein.
They can lobby. And they're very conscious of it, by the way. You can't go to a concert without seeing every chair named after some capitalist corporation or capitalist.
Yes.
And the reason for that is they want to be known that they're philanthropic with their money, when in fact, of course, they make the taxpayer pay. Right? I mean, you pay for most of that when they do that. But they're very, very clever so that they legitimate it. All these legal tools are about legitimating things which are abnormal. And that's what they're for.
They convince us to forge our own chains.
Terms, just to go back to the book, if I might, it does, not only does it give individual owners more power than they otherwise have, the bosses remain hidden. One of the terrible things that's happened in my lifetime is when I worked in industrial workplaces when I was young, you named the boss. You knew the boss. You hated him, and you scolded the boss. And now they talk about, the workers talk about the company or the corporation, and they don't know who the bosses are. They've got no idea who is actually making profits out of them. And that is, of course, a disempowering aspect of having corporations in between. More importantly, they can create intermediaries. One of the great, great things about a corporation is because it's instantly adult as soon as you create it. It can actually, because it's now a person, can create another corporation instantly. That's what we call them, subsidiaries. And that one can create others so that you get a whole family of corporations all connected through the same shareholders and the same investors, all connected, pretending that they're all separate persons. Well, that allows corporations, the owners, to distance themselves from the workers legally so they no longer become responsible personally. That's what you see in franchising. Yeah. That's what you see with employment agencies. Well, that's what you see with so-called independent contractor cases. Yeah. All the cases where employers avoid the responsibility for the debts they owe and the harms they do to workers.
Well, thank you. Harry, we're going to have to go.
Okay.
Thank you very much. It's a great book, Law at Work, Coercion and Co-option of the Working Class, btlbooks.com. Thank you, Harry. This is Taylor Report. Pedro, thank you. We're going to get out of here right now.